Hello, I'm Krista Corrier, and today I'll be interviewing Professor James Reichert. He is currently an associate professor at Stanford University. Yes. Okay. Hello, my name is Krista Corrier. Today I'll be sorry. Okay, sure.
Talk here. Very okay. Important.
Okay, talk into this?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm gonna go check out
all right. And should I probably just call him before doing this? Because it's.
Yeah. So we're recording this right now. I'm still recording.
Oh, okay.
So whenever. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Hello, my name is Krista Corrier. Today I'll be interviewing Professor James Reichert. He is currently an associate professor at Stanford University, where he teaches modern Japanese literature and feminist studies. He earned his PhD at the University of Michigan, and he is currently a member of the Stanford University Queer Studies Coalition and organizes cultural events for the larger community. His book, In the Company of Men, discusses the interaction of the Japanese non-shoku tradition of homosexuality with the Western construct of homosexuality in 19th century Japanese literature. Okay, thanks. Okay, like, is this good? Mm-hmm. Is this good? Okay. Is this okay? Okay. Sure. I'm really not offended if you switch, okay? Okay. Hello, my name is Krista Corrier. Today, I'll be interviewing Professor James Reichert. He is currently an associate professor at Stanford University, where he teaches modern Japanese literature and feminist studies. He is a member of the Stanford University Queer Studies Coalition and organizes cultural events for the larger community. His book, In the Company of Men, discusses the interaction of the Japanese non-shoku tradition of homosexuality with the Western construct of homosexuality in 19th century Japanese literature. Okay, thanks. Okay. Okay, great, thanks. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, well, my pleasure.
Well, first of all, could you define what non-shoku is? And also, does it bear any similarities to contemporary constructions of homosexuality, or is it a fundamentally different way of expressing same-sex desire?
All right. Interesting question. So non-shoku is... consists of two characters. The first character is the character for man, and then the second character is the character for color, which also signifies desire. And so what the term basically means is desire directed toward a male object. And the assumption is that the desiring subject is also a male. And what non-shoku is opposed to is nyo-shoku or jo-shoku, which is the first character in that is woman, and then the second character is color or desire. So that means desire directed toward a woman, and the object of that desire is female. But again, the desiring subject is male. So what you're talking about is a way of viewing sexuality from the perspective of an adult male sexual subject who either desires to have sexual partners who are also male or desires to have sexual partners who are female. And then one other element of non-shoku is that there is an idea built into it that the sexual object, the male who is the object of that sexual desire, is invariably younger than or junior to the desiring subject. So it's a typically a relationship that involves an adult male, and then the partner is younger, an adolescent, typically. So in that sense, I think it's really different from contemporary notions of, you know, gayness or lesbian identity for lots of reasons. First, I guess, and foremost, is that there is no space in that construction of non-shoku versus neo-shoku for any kind of lesbian identity, because the assumption is that the desiring subject always has to be a male. And so the concept of a female who desires another female, I'm sure that happened and was as statistically common as it is now. There was no way of talking about it in the received language for thinking about sexuality. And so, again, I guess another thing I should say is that what we're talking about with non-shoku and yo-shoku are constructions of sexuality that were prevalent in Japan and started, say, in the 15th century and really became established in the 16th and 17th century. So so we're talking about medieval and early modern Japan is the period where this, you know, taxonomy or whatever you want to call it of sexuality became established. So one reason it's different from contemporary notions of sexuality is that it's completely there's no space for the notion of a desiring female subject. Another way I think it's different is that there is an assumption that relationships are invariably hierarchical and that there's always sort of a dominant partner and a subordinate partner. And so the desiring male subject is always the dominant partner, and then his object, whether it's female or male youth, is always sort of the passive subordinate partner. So that notion of hierarchy, which is really prevalent in Japanese culture in general at that time. So I think those are two major differences. And I mean, I could go on forever if you want me to, but do you want me to go on, or do you have follow-up questions, or how would you like to do this?
If you'd like to go on, that'd be great. I do have follow-up questions too.
All right. Well, then one other thing that is different, I think, is, my sense, and I could be wrong, but is that the way people understand sexuality now is kind of an idea that it's something, you know, it's not a lifestyle choice. It's something that you're born with. So it has some kind of anatomical or fundamental, you know, component of a person's almost physical identity. Mm-hmm. And so it's often viewed through a kind of medical or biological or, you know, genetic lens or something like that, so a scientific lens. And in Japan, it was seen as really cultural. And so there were certain classes that were thought to favor non-shoku or male-male sexuality. And there were certain geographical regions where the people were thought to favor this, but the idea that it somehow was related to something that you were born with, or that you was part of your anatomy or part of your genetic system, which they didn't even have a concept of, wasn't part of it at all. But it was seen as very cultural. So the two classes that were really associated with it were the samurai class, the warrior class, and then the Buddhist clergy. And then one other group, I guess, would be patrons of the Kabuki Theater. And so it was really seen as class-based and kind of arising out of cultural affiliations and things like that. Another, I guess, feature that's tied to non-shoku that I don't think is as prevalent or differentiates it from modern constructions of same-sex sexuality is it was very tied with a very misogynist view of women, and that a lot of, particularly in samurai context, there was a desire to create, you know, male-male relationships because that was thought to encourage a kind of hyper-masculinity. And so association with women was thought to be potentially weakening behavior. And so in that sense, the practice was popular among samurai. In Buddhist context, there was a notion in Buddhist cosmology that women are less able to achieve enlightenment than men, and in a lot of contexts, they supposedly can't achieve enlightenment at all. And so in the Buddhist context, it was thought that, you know, ideally, a Buddhist priest shouldn't have sexual relations with anybody, but if he was going to have sexual relations, it would be better to have sexual relations with someone on a higher cosmic level, being another male, than with a woman. So that was kind of the logic there. And then the Kabuki theater, Kabuki is a theatrical tradition in Japan in which all the parts are played by men. And so you had fans of that theater who would engage in, you know, they would patronize certain actors, and one aspect of that patronage was also some kind of, you know, sexual relationship. So it really was, you know, a part of the cultural fabric at the time, and seen as offering insights into, you know, the kind of the way a person saw his place in society, the way a person viewed culture, viewed art, viewed entertainment, all of those things.
Wow, that's really interesting.
That was a long answer.
That's great. Okay, so for my follow-up question, in your book, sure, and in your response just now, mm-hmm, you discussed that non-sugar relationships were based on a gendered hierarchy, with one partner,
right,
being like soft, feminine, subordinate, and penetrated, and
mm-hmm,
the other was hard, masculine, dominant, and penetrating.
Right, right.
So to what extent, if any, were same-sex relationships acceptable in pre-modern Japan because they're analogous to male-female relationships?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the...
Oh, sorry.
I got everything until I couldn't quite hear you when you said, are they just sort of the second part of the question?
Okay. To what extent were same-sex relationships acceptable in pre-modern Japan because they're analogous to male-female relationships?
That's a good question. I think that's a really good question. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that is part of the logic, is that it's similar to a male-female relationship in the way that people viewed male and female relationships at the time. And so I think that was so it wasn't seen as some radically different way of envisioning romance or desire or love or something like that. But it's seen as fitting into the same model as the conventional male-female relationship. So I think that in that sense, that contributed a lot to its wide social acceptance. And so, for example, if you had had relationships in which, you know, a younger, you know, socially inferior partner was sexually dominating a more socially established adult male, you know, that, I think, if non-shoku, you know, encouraged and contributed to those kind of relationships, you know, that would be seen as destabilizing and perhaps not a positive thing. And so, you know, I think exactly as your question suggests, it's that it kind of reinforces social order and gender order in a way that parallels the way people looked at conventional male-female relationships, and therefore I think that is a huge part, actually, contributing to its wide social acceptance.
Okay, that's really interesting.
That's a good question.
Thanks. So did the ideal construct of femininity change at all in response to the rise of, like, heteronormativity? Because you discussed in your book a lot of really misogynist characters trying,
mm-hmm,
to support male-female relationships.
Yeah, so the idea of femininity, so maybe we're talking about now in, say, modern Japan?
Yeah, and the Meiji?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's no question. I think you can see that, you know, manifesting itself in lots of different and interesting ways during the Meiji period. So the Meiji period is, 1868 to 1920. 2012, and so it's the period when Japan opened up and started to modernize, and there was this huge influx of, well, there was this period of really active engagement with the rest of the world, so not only with the West, but also with China and the rest of East Asia, and so part of that, as you suggest, is that notions of sexuality, you know, changed really radically, and I think that ideas about femininity also change really radically. I mean, in a whole, you know, lots of different ways. I think, you know, one of the most important changes that kind of tangentially relates to these two issues is the rise of, like, the modern nuclear family as an important social unit. And I think that one thing we see in the Meiji period is Japan became increasingly invested in a policy of, you know, a policy of militarization and very aggressive engagement with its immediate neighbors. There was a real interest in, you know, developing, maintaining the army and increasing the population so that you had, you know, a large population of potential soldiers. And so I think, and so this became a real overarching concern of the Japanese government in modern times. And actually, there were all kinds of studies that were sponsored by the Japanese government in which they would estimate, you know, in order for Japan to maintain its military strength and be able to administer its increasingly large colonial empire, that, you know, the population had to grow by such and such a rate every year in order to make this a feasible undertaking. And so there were all of these incredible pro-natalist policies that the Japanese state instituted. And so I think that both in relation to changing notions of male-male sexuality and in relation to ideas about femininity, I think they connect a lot, because male-male sexuality was seen as non-procreative. And so even though it had this long tradition and association with military culture, it was seen as, in many ways, not amenable to this new pro-natalist policy. And also the role of women, and particularly as wives and mothers, and most specifically as mothers, became more and more important. And so you have this idea of the good wife, wise mother, which becomes a really dominant figure starting in mid-Meiji and all through the pre-war years. This idea of mothers who would, you know, bear lots of children and raise them, and that their main goal of raising these kids was to produce soldiers for the Imperial Army if the need should arise. And just on a sort of weird tangent, there is a really interesting movie called Rikugun, or The Army. So it's a wartime movie, but it really is kind of the apotheosis of this view, in which it's all about a family. It's kind of a historical overview. It starts in the Meiji period, and it takes them all the way to the present, which is 1943. And the key part of that, the key character in that movie is the mother. And the whole point of the movie is that she's a devoted mother, and she's played by one of the most popular actresses in Japan at the time. But at the climax of the movie, which is set in the 1940s, when her son is called into the army and is marching off, that it's a moment of kind of celebration for her, that she loves her child, but she realizes that she's always raised her child for this particular moment where she can, in a sense, hand him over to the emperor. So, long answer again to your question is that, yeah, I think that changing notions about male-male sexuality were really closely linked to changes in the way that people started to view, you know, what idealized femininity was. And I think it connects to this idea of procreation and and growing the population.
Okay, so all of it really came back to the needs of the state?
Yes. I'm sorry, so it came back to the state?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, I don't want to... that's a good question, because I don't want to suggest that somehow Excuse me.
Are you okay?
I'm just aspirated something. The state, I don't want to suggest that the state somehow had mind control over all the populations or that it was this totally top-down dynamic in which the state was, effortlessly manipulating the population.
Right.
But at the same time, I think you make a good point. Yeah, the state was a major player in encouraging these new ideas about sexuality and about gender. And then I think it was also encouraged by just other important phenomena. For example, that Japan was having so much more exposure to, say, the West and Western Europe and the United States, where practices like male-male sexuality and female-female sexuality were frowned upon. And so I think that that influenced Japan. Also, I think it's important to keep in mind that in China, and particularly Qing period China, which is sort of contemporaneous to Meiji Japan, that there was, that was also an environment that was pretty critical of same-sex sexuality, at least in official discourse. So, I mean, I think Japan was being exposed to lots of rhetoric that was saying these practices were bad. So I think in that sense, it was not just the state as an actor encouraging these pronatalist policies, but there also were influences like exposure to these new ideas. And then I think just the idea of the nuclear family, which I think is kind of a cornerstone of modern society, was was not conducive to same-sex sexual practices. So I think those kind of things weren't necessarily promoted by the state, but were just part and parcel of this larger transition to a capitalist, urban, modern nation state.
All right. In your book, you explained that nunchoku was primarily associated with the samurai class and with the Buddhist clergy and kabuki prostitution, you discussed earlier in the interview. Were there ways of engaging in nunchoku relationships that were available to the lower classes before the Meiji?
Absolutely, there must have been. And just like there had to have been examples of female-female sexual relations.
Right.
I think that there had to have been, all kinds of male-male sexual relations that didn't fit this model, and so this model being these kind of unequal hierarchical relationships, and also relationships that were, located in these specific cultural spheres, the samurai, the Buddhist clergy, or the kabuki theater. Things were happening outside of that, but I think in the literature of the period, which is in some ways the only documentation we have of what people were doing, and since there was nothing like journalism or any of that occurring at the time, we're pretty much stuck with looking at sources that probably just reinforced these ideas. And so the literature at the time pretty much restricted itself to talking about the samurai, the Buddhist clergy, and the nanshoku and the kabuki, the world of the kabuki theater. And so I think it is a product of just the way people were writing about it. And so I think it's a great example of how documents from the past can often only give us a very limited picture of what was happening in the past, and that getting to that that culture that existed outside the official culture is really hard to get at. And so in the case of Edo period Japan, it would be hard to find documentary evidence because people weren't writing that much about the peasants, and if they were writing about the peasants, they were writing about them in really prescribed ways. So they would talk about their productivity in the sphere of agriculture or something like that, and they wouldn't necessarily focus on the kind of sexual cultures that were prevalent among that group. I mean, and if they did, they were often talking about it in the context of actually of courtship practices among peasants, men and women. So, yeah, I think. So, yeah, I think it was absolutely happening, but it's hard to find evidence of that.
Okay. Okay.
And yeah, I don't know how you would. Maybe you could. Probably the place that you could find it would be because there actually was a large. Japan was quite a literate society at that time, and there was a large segment of the peasant population was also literate, and so out in the countryside there must have been lots of people keeping diaries, and even though the composition of a diary is also often prescribed in certain ways that you only talk about certain things in a diary, I'm sure that there would be written accounts of relationships among lower class rural segments of the population that could be looked at. It's just that no one has really looked at that stuff yet, so it's probably out there. It's harder to access, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's really interesting. So for my next question.
Sure.
Yeah, the construct of masculinity that the state promoted changed quite a few times over the course of the Meiji period.
Oh, yeah.
And the problematic masculine traits that the state was trying to eradicate, also kept shifting. So was there a clear binary between samurai masculinity and state-sponsored masculinity? And to what extent did the boundaries blur?
Interesting. I guess I would start out saying no. There's not a clear binary because what you get over the course, at least what I would say you get over the course of the Meiji period, is an effort by the Meiji state to kind of co-opt the ideal of samurai masculinity and incorporate it into a kind of modern imperialist military worldview. And so what I mean by that is that, for people who don't know about the history of Japan, Japan, the Meiji Restoration is an example in which the Tokugawa period from about 1615 to 1867 was a governmental structure in which a specific military house was basically in charge of the country, but the country is divided up into lots of autonomous domains in which the warlords had connections with personal connections of loyalty to the house, the Tokugawa house. And that is overthrown by a kind of military coup, actually, in the 1860s. And the catalyst for that is it's seen that the Tokugawa regime is not able to respond effectively to increasingly aggressive incursions into Japan by Western imperialist powers, particularly the Russian Empire and the United States and Great Britain. And so this military group that sees the Tokugawa regime as ineffective in protecting Japan overthrows them and reinstalls the emperor as the supposed head of state, although the emperor pretty much figures as a figurehead. So you get an interesting situation where you basically have one military group overthrowing another military group to start the Meiji period. But this new military group, which becomes the Meiji regime, is very concerned about all of the other segments of the samurai, former samurai population. And there is a concern that some other group of samurai is going to then in turn overthrow the Meiji regime. And so at the beginning of the Meiji period, there's a real effort by the Meiji leaders to, in a sense, weaken or defang the samurai population, because a lot of their policies, for example, involve the abolition of the old class system in which samurai lose a lot of their hereditary status and privileges, And so there, I think there's an understandable concern on the part of the Meiji regime that a lot of these samurai are going to be really unhappy about this and this new system. And, you know, this is a population of armed individuals who have had military training throughout their lives. So I think it was, you know, pretty reasonable for the Meiji regime to assume, oh, these people are going to, you know, there's a chance they could rise up and challenge these new policies, which in fact happened in, you know, fairly early in the Meiji period with the Satsuma Rebellion, where you had a group of recalcitrant samurai who tried to overthrow the Meiji regime. So in the beginning then, back to your question, the Meiji regime had a very, you know, complicated relationship with the samurai, with the still present samurai tradition in Japan, because these, you know, these are people who had grown up in the Edo period, self-identified as samurai, and you know, they had lost a lot of the privileges, but in their minds they were still samurai. So, you know, this was still something that was existed in Japan and was very much alive. And so early in the Meiji regime, there are lots of efforts on the one hand to kind of tame the samurai, to in a way demilitarize them and undermine a lot of cultural practices that's associated with the samurai class. And so as part of this, that's part of, I think, why you get so much really overt anti-nanshoku rhetoric coming out of the Meiji regime at the beginning of the Meiji period, because it's part of this larger program to criticize this, you know, the samurai, and to, in a sense, you know, not undermine them, but weaken them. But at the very same time, as you point out, there's also a sense that, you know, Japan, in order to maintain its position in the world, it needs to, or to improve its position in the world, actually, from the perspective of the Meiji regime, needed to strengthen its military. And so at the same time that they're trying to undermine certain factions and certain aspects of samurai culture, there are also efforts to encourage other aspects of samurai culture. And basically, what the Meiji regime doesn't want is, it doesn't want kind of cliques forming and factions forming among warriors, but it wants to encourage warriors who see all of their loyalty not directed to an individual lord or to a comrade, but to the state. And so that's one reason why there is a real concern about male-male sexuality, particularly amongst samurai, is that there's a sense that if these kind of really intense relationships are forming between these warriors, these former warriors, then there's a danger that that could become the locus of some kind of clique or faction or something that would start fomenting against the government. And so the goal was then to kind of sever the horizontal relationships between the different warriors and to have them all looking towards the state. So I think that that really gets to the heart of early Meiji criticism, or the very fraught relationship with samurai tradition that we see. And then, as you said, it keeps on changing. By mid-Meiji, so say by the 1890s or the first decade of, you know, even late Meiji, the first decade of the 20th century, you know, the concerns about having samurai get together and try to overthrow the Meiji regime, they'll start to disappear. There's a sense that there really isn't any group in Japan that is going to have resources to mount a legitimate challenge to the Meiji state, because the Meiji state's getting more and more powerful, and so there's less of a kind of almost paranoid concern about warriors. And so at that time, when you get later in the Meiji regime, when the state is becoming more powerful, then you start getting an interesting situation in which efforts to co-opt samurai traditions become, you know, easier or less threatening. And there's a sense that, you know, we can even allude to same-sex sexuality in very coded and veiled ways, but it's not as loaded as it used to be in the beginning of the Meiji period. And so then by the end of the Meiji period, you have all kinds of you know, material being written by Japanese intellectuals and journalists and cultural commentators, in which they are praising to the heavens the Japanese martial traditions and in many cases, even alluding to the romanticized view of these romantic male friendships that existed in the samurai period. But there's a sense that all of this is being utilized to, or as I said, I keep on using this word co-opted, but it's being co-opted by the state and is part and parcel of this larger effort to create a military that is, always working to forward the aims of the state. So as you say, it the binary breaks down, and it's never a perfect binary. And the Meiji, the modern Japanese up through World War II state always has an interesting relationship with its samurai past, because in a way it's something that differentiates Japan from the rest of East Asia. It's very closely tied to its military and imperial ambitions, but at the same time it is kind of the seeds of the possibility of social disorder, and so that results in a complicated engagement that doesn't break down into a simple for or against, as you said. There, I think I'm done with that.
That was a great answer.
Oh well, I don't know about that, but.
So you've already touched on this a bit, but the Meiji state's stance around nanshoku was influenced a lot by Western medical discourse.
Mm-hmm.
But this is kind of what you're discussing, some samurai values were still retained, and Meiji literature still drew on some quintessentially Japanese traditions. So to what extent is this transition away from nanshoku towards compulsory heterosexuality a perfect narrative of westernization, or is it complicated?
Oh yeah, I think again it's I think it's really hard to read it as westernization, and one of the things I really focus on in talking about in my classes and in talking about the Meiji period is, and I think the Meiji period is and Japan in general is such a great example to talk about alternative models of modernization, and that what's going on in Japan is definitely modernization, and Japan is modernizing, and modernity is, there's a definite, it exhibits, so much of what we think about as and define as modernity. But at the same time, I think that it's not an imitation of the West or an effort to take Western values and implant them in Japan or something like that. That it's an alternative modernity, and I think there are just millions of examples of that. I mean, if you look at all kinds of literature from the Meiji period or all kinds of art forms and sociological developments, that they really show that what's happening there is not it's not unique because Japan is always unique, but it's what's happening in Japan is unique to Japan. What's happening in China is unique to China. What's happening in India is unique to India. But I think it's definitely a case that the kind of what we think of as the modern in Japan is very distinct to what's going on in Japan. And so I think the way of talking about same-sex sexuality is a good way to get at that. And so one classic example I think is that actually, and I don't even think I mentioned this in the book, but the whole rhetoric or the whole language of dosei, so as you say, the way of thinking about same-sex sexuality changes over the course of the Meiji period. And in the beginning of the Meiji period, it's very much connected to nanshoku, which is this Edo tradition. But by the end of the Meiji period, you have a whole new terminology. And the key term is dosei, and the first character is do, the same. And then sei is sex, and then I is love, so same-sex love. And actually, the way in the Japanese context, which I think is very different from the way sort of the medicalization of same-sex sexuality occurred, say, in Europe, is that most of the time this term was actually not, as I said, I don't mention this in my book, is targeted at women and not at men. And so it's at this moment that you start to have what we would think of as the beginnings of a language to talk about same-sex relations among women. And what gives rise to this is the emergence of a higher education system, and specifically an education system for women, so schools for women, private schools for women, and different sort of higher schools for women. And as a response to this emergence of these new environments in which it's, you know, because schools in Meiji period were not co-educational. There were men's schools and there were women's schools. And so you have these new schools for women in which we have environments where all the students are women, most of the people who work in the schools are women, and most of the instructors, or many of them, are women, and the administrators, a lot of them, are women. And so there becomes, in the emerging popular press, this real curiosity, I mean, what are all these girls doing in these schools? And then one of the features of this schoolgirl culture is these really intense relationships between the schoolgirls. And so then there are all of these questions about, what are these girls doing? What kind of relationships are these? You know, is it natural or healthy for young girls to be so sort of intimately and passionately connected to each other? And so it's talking about these girls that it becomes the point of origin for the widespread use of terms like same-sex love and homosexuality. So it's really different from what's happening in the West. And so it's really a term that's initially used to talk about girls, and then it starts to be applied to boys later after that. So I think that's a great example of how, in a way, we're talking about, in some ways, parallel developments. I don't think you could ever read that as, it's just they're taking a Western view and applying it to Japan, that it's something very different and very distinct to that specific environment and the conditions of that historical moment. So, yeah, it's a great question. And
thanks.
And the whole schoolgirl thing is fascinating. It goes all the way through 1920s, 1930s, and there's a whole body of literature about these schoolgirl crushes, and there's all kinds of terminology about it, and it's a fascinating topic.
Wow. This next question is getting a bit away from your book, but
that's okay.
Thanks. One of your main arguments is that Nanchoku was still present to an extent in literature, even at the end of the Meiji period, even though it didn't have the same cultural force.
Mm-hmm.
So is it still present in some form in contemporary Japanese literature or pop culture?
Yeah, well, again, I think, there are so many different options. So when you're talking about, let's talk about contemporary Japan. When you're talking about the way that male-male sexuality is represented in contemporary Japan, I mean, it's really diverse, and there are lots of different ways of representing it. And I think, depending on what kind of art audience is being targeted, so you have what we would think of now as gay literature or gay entertainment, which is material often produced by gay men for what is perceived to be or assumed to be a gay male audience, or stuff that's produced by gay women or lesbians, and is usually targeted towards a gay female audience. So that's one category. And a lot of the people who produce that kind of stuff, particularly, well, in both cases of male producers for male audiences and female producers for female audiences, they, I think, invoke the Nanchoku tradition all kinds of ways, and especially I think in the culture of male gay art and entertainment, it's pretty prevalent because it's something that's very close to home. It is can be viewed as gay positive in a lot of different ways. So I think that's one reason why you see people reworking it all the time, and then it's familiar, I think, is another reason. But then you also have just like in the United States, where you have lots of you know, girl-on-girl action stuff that's being targeted at a male heterosexual audience. Also in Japan, you have the opposite of that. You have lots of boy-on-boy entertainment that's targeted at a straight female audience. And I think in those cases, the invocations of nanshoku are different. In the kind of boys' love material that is so popular among straight Japanese women, which is typically produced by women, but the content is about male-male love, and then it's typically it's thought to be targeted at a female audience, but you never know exactly everybody who's reading it. But that stuff also, I think, in a way, reflects different elements of the old nanshoku tradition. So the classic aspect of that is that you have the whole idea of the Bishonen or the beautiful youth, which was a real important icon in nanshoku culture, becomes really central to this boys' love material that's being produced for straight women, where you have the beautiful young boy. But he's very kind of very manga-y. I mean, he's presented and he looks different and acts different than the beautiful youth would have back in the Edo period, but I think he's still, there's a connection because it's the same term and it's the focus on a young boy is really sexually attractive. And then I think another thing you typically see in a lot of these boys' love comics, and also a lot of material, material written by lesbians for a lesbian audience, by gay men for a gay male audience, is you see the idea that relationships are hierarchical. I mean, that still seems to suffuse the entertainment and the literature. There's just this notion that there's always going to be a sort of older, dominant partner, and there's always going to be a younger, subordinate partner. And that idea, although it doesn't necessarily mirror the way these relationships exist in the real world, still seems to be the most common way to present them in culture. So there's, in the language of the United States, there's always sort of a top and there's always a bottom, and those roles usually are pretty pretty rigid. I think it's still around, but it's changed. So, I mean, the idea of a straight female writer or artist producing comics for straight female audience, I mean, in that sense, the whole phenomenon is so radically removed from nanshoku, which has this whole kind of misogynist component to it. So in that sense, they're really different and really separated from each other. But they're taking selectively some of the archetypes and some of the patterns from that practice and reworking them in ways that they think are entertaining and exciting for their target audience. So it's an interesting situation how it is used now.
All right.
Are you a Shonen Ai fan, or do you like that kind of stuff? Or?
I have a lot of friends who are. I've encountered it.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. So.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think the most famous is Loveless. I think it's an animated series and a comic book series, and it's about musicians, and it's very, if you want to see what it's like, it's a good example.
Okay, thanks. So this question is getting kind of speculative, but
sure.
Great. One of your major arguments in the book is that the decline of nanshoku in literature was not inevitable. So how could nanshoku have remained a powerful cultural force in the Meiji?
That's a really interesting question. Let me think. Well, as I'm spinning my wheels, I think that the fact that it kind of, that the most explicit discussions of something like that shift to the environment of talking about women. So you have Yoshiya Nobuko, who writes tons of stories for young girls that deal with these really passionate, often pretty clearly sexual relationships that are occurring in the context of higher school. So All right, I think I have an answer. So the way that that is justified in so this is really so this is not kind of subcultural thing at all. It's a very mainstream development in Japan in the 19-teens, 1920s, and 1930s in talking about young women. But the way that it's often framed is that these relationships between girls are often preparatory relationships to get them ready for a heterosexual relationship with a man. And so I think in that way it became very easy to absorb these romantic tales of schoolgirl crushes into a larger narrative about the ultimate role for a woman is to become a wife and mother. So because this is seen as not necessarily interfering with that and as a kind of stepping stone along the way to becoming a productive and active female citizen in Japan. So I would guess, if I had to venture a guess, how that would you would have a parallel development on the male side, is that if somehow they could have taken that narrative of male-male sexuality and, you know, in the same way absorbed it into some idea that this is a precursor or a practice for what men are going to be doing later in their lives when they are either soldiers fighting for the emperor or, you know, fathers, you know, creating children for future wars. And I think you do see that sometimes. I think in my book, I think the best example of that is the historical novel called Bearded Man, in which I think you kind of get that pattern worked out in the story where the romantic, the romantic desire that the warriors in that story feel for each other becomes kind of a symbol for the intense devotion that a warrior should feel for the emperor. And so it becomes a kind of precursor for that, or a way of presenting that in terms that are understandable and identifiable to a reader. So, you know, I think, you know, if they could have come up with a strategy to make it even more amenable to the procreative nuclear family or the state in other ways, it probably could have maintained a more dominant place in literary culture. I think that's, you know, maybe that's one way it could have happened. Or if somehow it had been connected, because so much of modern Japanese literature is about the alien, you know, and I think this is important, that, you know, when you read mainstream Japanese literature from the Meiji period or the Taisho period, you know, the characters tend to be alienated from conventional social values, and so they're not productive citizens. They're certainly not rah-rah-rah for the empire building or something like that. And so somehow I think if male-male sexuality had been able to work itself into that model, perhaps that would have been another way for it to maintain a more central position in literary discourse at the time. Because I think that, for example, in the novel The Quilt, which is a novel about a married teacher who has a crush on a sexual obsession with his female student. And the whole point of the story, I think, is a lot of ways is that he's not a good husband, he's not a good father, he's not a good teacher, he's not a productive citizen in any way, he's very self-involved, and he feels sorry for himself. And he's sort of gauging all this problematic behavior. And, you know, I think you can read that story as I think it is kind of sympathetic towards the protagonist, even though he's not a tower of strength. He also is definitely operating outside, you know, mainstream values, and is kind of resistant to these values, and is, you know, embodying that resistance in negative ways, but he's still doing it. So I think that, you know, it doesn't seem that big a stretch that you could have a sort of non-shoku-esque character performing the same thing. But maybe because Nanshoku is so, the people who cherished it didn't want to present it in sort of negative terms like that, that maybe that sort of stood in their way. I don't know. But yeah, it's an interesting and complicated question. And I think there are lots of millions of different answers for how it, interesting ways that it could have continued to be prevalent.
Yeah, one of the things I really loved about your book was that you left it open to all those questions.
It's probably because I couldn't answer them, so I didn't try.
Sorry, I just meant that, like, you know, the possibility was there that it wasn't just a simple narrative.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, because I think that that was one thing I really wanted to emphasize, is that, yeah, it's... Yeah, it is multi-layered, and it has a lot of, it signifies in a lot of different ways, which I think is important. Yeah, so as you said before, it's not a simple binary, and it doesn't have a sort of black and white reading of it.
Well, I'm actually out of questions right now, so.
All right, where are we in terms of time?
Nearly done.
Oh, all right. Well, I really enjoyed it, and I hope that I hope I answered the question satisfactorily. I don't know. Is there anything? Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Yeah. So I talked to your professor, Adrian, and what did you envision for this interview? I mean, what was your goal for it?
Well, I really enjoyed your book, and I'm really interested.
Thank you very
much. Yeah, and I'm really interested in, like, homosexuality and different constructions of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because I feel like in some ways, like, the construct we have, like, in contemporary North American society is kind of limited, and it's just, really wanted to, like, hear your thoughts about different aspects of it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. No, I absolutely agree. I think, yeah, we are dealing there is a very limited way of talking about it still. I mean, and that was one thing I noticed in writing. There was a very limited way of talking about it back then, but it was a different limited way than the limited way we talk about it now. But, well, I'm glad to hear that.
All right. Well, thank you for the interview.
Well, thank you so much, and best of luck.
Great. Thanks. You too.
All right. So should I just hang up, or do I need to sign off?
Sure, if you want to hang up, that's fine. If you have things to do otherwise, you can talk to Krista for a bit.
Well, I assume you're busy. Is there anything else now that the interview is done, or are you good?
Well, I think I should also ask Natalia. Like, is it okay to end at this point? Or? Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, thank you for agreeing to the interview, and thank you for writing the book.
Oh, well, yeah, and thank you for reading it. You know, the
My
funny
pleasure.
Thing is when you read it, you do something like that, and you produce it, and then you feel like it sort of goes into a black hole or something, and you never hear about it. So it's great to know that you read it, and I really appreciate the nice things you had to say about it.
Thank you. Okay, well, have a good day.
Yeah, and good luck with your class.
Great, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Hey, Natalia?